Hello, I'm Fully Batibo. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, a remarkable return to power for the Marcos family in the Philippines. But how will Ferdinand Marcos Jr. tackle the country's financial problems? And can he revitalize the economy? Also this week, President Joe Biden says fighting inflation is his top domestic priority, and the Federal Reserve has imposed the highest rate hikes in more than two decades to tackle the problem. So will prices cool down? And India's worst power crisis in 6 years. Why is electricity getting increasingly rare for many Indians, and what can be done to keep the lights on? Thank you very much for joining us. The Philippines has been battered by the pandemic and a deep recession. Now, after more than 2 years of lockdowns, people are returning to their everyday lives. The economy is expected to outpace that of its neighbors, but there are serious challenges to achieving a robust recovery. Inflation is rising and government debt is high. All eyes are now on the new president's economic policies. Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the son and namesake of a controversial former president, is set to lead the country for the next 6 years. That would mark the return of his family to power 36 years after they were ousted by a popular revolution. Their supporters say the period saw a lot of progress on the infrastructure level. Critics accuse them of corruption, and a government commission is still running after billions worth of ill-gotten wealth allegedly accumulated by the Marcos family. Now, Marcos's running mate for vice president is Sara Duterte Carpio, the daughter of the outgoing leader Rodrigo Duterte. And many of her supporters have voted to see a continuation of her father's policies. Well, let's have a look at how the economy fared during Duterte's rule. The Philippines economy contracted by 9.5% in 2020, largely due to pandemic restrictions, but the GDP grew by 5.6% last year. Public debt stood at 61% of gross domestic production at the end of 2021. Not ringing alarm bells yet, but hardly a comfortable starting point. Headline inflation, or the rate of increase in prices of basic commodities, accelerated to 4.9% last month. That's the highest since December of 2018. The country's unemployment rate stood at 5.8%, while the figure is down from earlier months. Underemployment, or the number of people with jobs who are looking for more hours of work to make ends meet, rose to 15.8%. And the number of Filipinos living in poverty has now risen to over 26 million, just under 25% of the population. Marcos has given very few policy details on the campaign trail, but he plans to continue Duterte's build, build, build signature infrastructure program. He's also vowed to create more jobs, revitalize the economy, and is considering subsidies to tame oil prices. So, what's next for the Philippines economy? To discuss that, I'm joined by Alex Holmes, who's an emerging markets economist specializing in emerging Asia and capital economics. He's joining us from Singapore. Thank you very much, Alex, for being with us. So, is Marcos Jr.'s election good news or bad news for the Philippines economy?
It's hard to say really how it will turn out, because we don't know huge amounts about what his policy platform is, other than the things that you briefly mentioned. But it is going to be hard for him to shake off the fears about nepotism and corruption, given his family connections.
His commitment to voters indeed have been very vague. His promise to lower the prices of basic goods, building infrastructure as well, and steering the Philippines out of the economic slowdown caused by the pandemic. But how specifically is he going to do this? What do you think should be his top priority?
Well, I think infrastructure is a good place to focus. The Philippines has some of the worst infrastructure in the region, and really that damages it by making it a hard place to do business. The logistical performance of getting things across the country or to ports to ship onwards means that it hasn't been able to develop a competitive manufacturing and export sector to the same extent as some of its neighbours. So that's really a good place to concentrate. Another good place to concentrate would be the overall business environment. So that includes things like investor-friendly policies, and political stability. The government have made some progress on this. Mm. So recently they reformed foreign direct investment rules, but there's plenty of distance to go, right, and plenty of things that could be improved further.
On infrastructure, he's expected to complete Duterte's build infrastructure works, which were delayed by the pandemic, of course. Do you think that can help him show tangible results? I mean, has that infrastructure plan been a success in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, one side effect we saw of the infrastructure drive prior to the pandemic was that Duterte perhaps tried to go a little bit too fast. Mm. There was a big spike in imports of capital goods in order to supply the infrastructure drive, but that saw the current account deficit widen quite considerably, and it weighed heavily on the peso, pushing up inflation. So Marcos will have to be careful that he doesn't go too fast and try to build too much too quickly. Otherwise, it's going to create frictions in the economy and maybe cause problems with the current account.
Right. And Marcos will inherit a huge amount of debt, won't he, from the previous administration. How much will that limit his room, you think, to take on more debt to finance government projects or support growth?
Well, a country like the Philippines can't be completely carefree about its debt burden. It's still a relatively risky market for investors, and it doesn't have completely easy borrowing. But the level of debt that the Philippines has is actually comparable to other emerging markets, not that high. So as long as Marcos doesn't run massively wide deficits, we think that the fiscal position will remain sustainable for a fast-growing country such as the Philippines.
Hmm. Alex, what about the relationship with China? Will he, like Duterte, pursue investments with China? Because Duterte's overtures to Beijing had somewhat mixed results.
Yeah, I mean, leaving aside the kind of pros and cons of going to China for investment and business links, I mean, it's not necessarily a given that China would be forthcoming with investment. The picture from 2016 and 17, when Duterte came to power, is very different now. China has rolled back a lot of its foreign investments. For instance, the Belt and Road initiative has been rolled back quite a lot. Mm. And it's dealing with an acute crisis of its own at the moment with a COVID outbreak. So it's not necessarily the case that China would be willing to lend money with little conditions to the Philippines. So focusing the efforts on China might not yield massive results.
Right.
And also, a greater relationship with China would come at the cost of their close ties with the US, which the Philippines have much greater economic links with.
Indeed, and surveys have shown that Filipinos are somewhat still very mistrustful of Beijing. If not China, what about securing other foreign investments, given his family's complicated past? I mean, do you think foreign investors will want to engage with him?
Yeah, I mean, it's as I mentioned earlier, it's all about improving the business environment. So improving the laws and the ease of doing business, improving infrastructure and political stability. I suppose the part where Marcos is perhaps weakest on is political stability, given the sort of hang-ups that is attached to his name and the fact that also his vice president is the daughter of a current president. Investors are going to still be concerned that, you know, about poor governance.
Thank you so much for your insight. Thank you, Alex Holmes, joining us there from Singapore. Now, faced with soaring prices and an expanding job market, the U.S. Federal Reserve has announced the highest increase in interest rates in more than two decades. The central bank aims to handle inflation by cooling the economy and make its coronavirus recovery more sustainable. But it's feared the Fed's decision to increase borrowing costs could trigger a recession. U.S. President Joe Biden has reiterated his support for the Fed's efforts and set out his plans to tackle rising prices.
While families struggle to pay their bills, some corporate executives are on earnings calls with investors on Wall Street cheering their record profits and explain how they're using this period of inflation to cover the rise in prices far beyond what they need to do to cover their costs. And all this time, they're not even paying for a fair share of taxes in the first place. You want to bring down inflation? Let's make sure the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share.
While the Federal Reserve said it was lifting its benchmark interest rate by half a percentage point to a range of 0.75% to 1% after a smaller rise in March. And with U.S. inflation at a 40-year high, more hikes are expected. Inflation in the U.S. slowed last month for the first time since August. Prices still increase, but at a slower pace. The Consumer Price Index was up 8.3%, a decrease from the 8.5% recorded in March. Besides interest rates rises, the Fed aims to scale back the huge injection of monetary stimulus pumped into the economy. It plans to reduce its $9 trillion balance sheet by shrinking its portfolio of treasuries and agency mortgage-backed securities. The Federal Reserve's latest moves are likely to push the dollar further up. The U.S. dollar index has reached the highest level in 20 years. But the U.S. gross domestic product shrank at a 1.4% annual pace in the first 3 months of this year, the first drop since the second quarter of 2020. Now, the move by the bank in charge of the world's largest economy will make it more expensive for people and businesses to borrow. Gulf states whose currencies are tied to the dollar have responded to the Fed with interest rate rises of their own. That's while central banks in several countries are tightening borrowing costs in an effort to cushion businesses and consumers from inflation. Well, joining us now to talk more about this from London is Richard Siegel, who's a research analyst with the London-based financial institution Ambrosia Capital. Thank you very much for being with us, Richard. So President Biden, we heard this week, blame the runaway prices on Republican tax and economic proposals. They, in turn, have blamed him. Who's right? Who is to blame, or what is to blame for the rising cost of living in the U.S.?
I would say some of each, but also neither. There are a variety of factors, including rising imported commodity prices, supply chain imbalances, the recovery from the pandemic, which was faster than expected, but also imbalances in the labor market, along with the fiscal stimulus, which was popular among both parties. It's really the task for the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government to adjust monetary policy so that supply and demand come into balance, but also so that fiscal policy is oriented in the future to provide more stability in terms of market and business expectations.
Biden said he couldn't predict how long these inflated prices would be a fact of American life. Tell us more about the plan he announced this week. Will his policies help, you think?
I think it will to some extent, but really what the country needs, if we're just looking at inflation alone, is to look at the parts of the index which are rising most sharply. These include energy, not surprisingly. That will sort itself out by its own, but partly that's out of the control of U.S. government officials. But it's also areas such as housing, which are rising by more than 5% per year. And there, the government can take steps to improve the supply of housing in order to redress that imbalance. There are a lot of small things that the government can do, but there isn't any magic bullet, and these all will take a long time. Because a degree of inflation has become entrenched.
No magic bullet, you say, Richard. The Federal Reserve has hiked interest rates, as we've seen, in its strongest move to tame these rising prices. But some have said that this is too little, too late. Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't on that point. I would say it's too late, but not too little. In terms of timing, I think the Fed is behind the curve, although not significantly, perhaps 3 to 6 months, which in the grand scheme of things is not that significant. However, by claiming that the inflation that which was seen last year and early this year was, in their words, transitory, they led everyone to believe that things would become under control very quickly. And by moving too late, it doesn't really affect the economy that much, but it affects expectations a lot. They've created a lot of volatility in terms of expectations, but also market volatility. And this makes it much more difficult for corporations to raise money. And the volatility also hurts consumer confidence.
Right. What about the rising dollar? How does that benefit the economy? Could that help decrease the inflation pressure?
It helps a little because it can temper the impact of the rise in imported commodity prices, but it doesn't help that much because what economists call pass-through in the U.S. is very low just because the U.S. is such a vast economy. Again, it helps, but it doesn't help that much. And on the other hand, it can hurt the growth figures because it leads to falling exports and rising imports. And that was the major reason GDP contracted in the first quarter, as you mentioned.
The R word, Richard, recession is being bandied around a lot. Is the U.S. at risk of a recession just 2 years after emerging from one?
There is always a risk. I don't think you can rule one out completely, but there is already so much stimulus in the economy already. Real interest rates will remain sharply negative in real terms for a number of years to come. The labor force participation rate is rising, and the strength of the dollar will encourage consumption. So I don't think a recession on an outright basis is likely. However, we are in for a period of slower growth, which to that extent will help slow inflation over time, if not very quickly.
Can the Federal Reserve, you think, engineer a soft landing? The markets don't seem convinced about that.
I wouldn't say a soft landing is very likely. On the other hand, if we are to avoid a recession and if inflation is to slow gradually, then I think there's a pretty strong chance that if it isn't necessarily soft, it might just be a bumpy landing without a crash.
Richard, how will the measures taken by the U.S., the world's largest economy, affect other countries, especially emerging markets?
That's where I am more worried. A lot of these countries, and we could pick any of them, we could pick Indonesia, we could pick Egypt, we could pick Brazil or Mexico. The rise in U.S. rates, but also the uncertainties that the Fed indecision, will they raise by 50 basis points, will they raise by 75 basis points, causes a lot of volatility in their markets and their exchange rates, but also makes it much more difficult for companies in those countries, as well as the governments, to raise money abroad. And that volatility can lead to a lot of downwardly revised expectations, both from businesses and consumers, and lead to a lot less foreign investment.
Thank you so much for your insight, Richard. Richard Siegel is a research analyst with the London-based financial institution Ambrosia Capital. Thank you for joining us on Counting the Cost. Now, as temperatures soared to an all-time high in India, so did the demand for electricity. But due to the country's worst power crisis in 6 years, air conditioners, machines and lights have been switched off for long hours during the day. The main reason for the shortage? Not enough coal. The fossil fuel accounts for more than 70% of the country's electricity generation. And India is the world's second largest producer and consumer of coal. But stocks are said to be critically low in 108 of its 173 power plants. Imports are becoming more unaffordable as the war in Ukraine drives the prices of coal and natural gas up. Joining us now to talk more about the power crisis in India is Vibhuti Garg, who's in New Delhi. She's India lead energy economist at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. Thank you very much for joining us, Vibhuti. So coal shortages and high temperatures are largely to blame for this crisis in India, but are there other underlying factors here?
So apart from high temperature and coal shortages, you know, the other key underlying factors are actually coal transportation has been a key bottleneck. So while there has been coal with Coal India, but rake availability for coal transportation has been a constraint. Secondly, I would say power producers have not been maintaining enough coal stock at their end. So while the requirement is for them to maintain for about 24 days or minimum of 2 weeks of coal supply at their end. But most of the power plants in the last one and a half years have been maintaining only coal stock for 9 to 10 days. And this has led to a bit of a panic situation. And one of the reasons for them to, you know, have less coal at their end is because the distribution companies to whom they sell power owe huge payments to the developers. This in turn kind of impacts their cash flow of, and then the developers find it difficult to make payments for coal procured from Coal India. Another reason why the shortage could have been met through imports, but imported coal prices are an all-time high. So it's about 3 to 4 times higher than the prices prevailing a year back. And this makes imported coal very expensive, and thus distribution companies have been avoiding, you know, buying expensive coal power.
So what's the government plans then to fix this stockpile problem?
Immediately, the government is kind of trying to avoid the crisis by ramping up domestic production as well as asking captive generators to generate at maximum. In the month of April 2022 alone, you know, Coal India raised about its production by 27%. However, the offtake increase was only 6%. And one of the reasons which I highlighted was the unavailability of freight corridor. Government has also opened up 20 closed mines to the private sector. Further, government is reviewing its stranded coal capacity, and public sector undertakings like NTPC are taking charge of them.
Vibhuti, what about renewable energy? What about renewable energy? Can India wean itself off coal?
I would say India has set up huge targets for renewable energy by 2030 and net zero by 2070. And while India has a big coal fleet and it will continue for some time, but what we need to see is that we don't build any new more coal power plants apart from one which are already under construction. Investing in energy choices for 2 to 3 years in the interim can lock limited financial resources, because any investment, you know, in thermal assets at any stage of value chain, whether even it's coal mining, will lock investment for at least another 25 to 30 years or even more. So, which is not desirable.
Right.
What India needs to do is, in order to meet its increasing demand, you know, more and more renewable needs to be added. Mm-hmm. And if you'll see, renewable prices are in fact deflationary, and the coal prices are inflationary on the other hand.
Right. You've told us, Vibhuti,
pathway should be more sustainable.
Right. You've told us about what India needs to do. I guess what we want to find out now is what impact these power cuts have had on businesses and the Indian economy as a whole.
All those consumers, whether it's industries, agricultural or residential consumers, are all getting impacted. So the demand for industrial production just started picking up after the impact of COVID-19. And now their production is getting impacted with scheduled power outages, thereby impacting the GDP of the country. Also, you know, there is welfare loss as residential consumers are facing the heat by having to spend time in the smoldering heat wave without power.
Thank you so much for talking to us about this, Vibhuti Garg from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis in New Delhi. Thank you for your time. Now, an iconic painting of Hollywood actress Marilyn Monroe by Andy Warhol has smashed records after selling for $195 million, making it the most expensive piece of 20th century art ever sold. The proceeds will be donated to a foundation that supports children's health and education programs. Victoria Gatenby has a story.
Andy Warhol's portrait of Marilyn Monroe was expected to shatter records for contemporary art. The sale at Christie's Auction House in New York attracted international interest. The painting, Shot Sage Blue Marilyn, is one in a series and the first to be auctioned off in nearly 25 years. Bidding started at $100 million and it sold in less than 4 minutes to a US art dealer.
At $170 million for the Warhol, it's selling here. You, sir, $170 million.
With taxes and fees included, the final price came to $195 million. The proceeds will be donated to charity.
If you think about, you know, Warhol prices, the Warhol record was at $103 million for the silver car crash. This almost doubled it. And again, 20th century works of art, American works of art, it's the highest price ever paid. Close to $200 million. Let it sink in. It's quite something.
Warhol created the famous silkscreen image of Monroe following the death of the actress after she took an overdose of sleeping pills in 1962. 60 years later, the public is still fascinated by her life and death. And perhaps no other painting has ever been so well poised to capitalise on post-pandemic pent-up demand to see and purchase art. Victoria Gatenby for Counting the Cost.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at FolibaAJE and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or drop us an email, countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That will take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Foliba Thibault from the whole team here in Doha. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.